Boker Tov, Erev Tov. Hope everybody's doing well. A pleasure to welcome back Rabbi Adam Mintz to start this four-part series on Erevin. I just got the book, Building Communities, A History of the Arab in America. I just arrived Monday evening, so I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but please go out before the series is over. Besides, this is, of course, his book is, I guess, his PhD was on the history of Erevin, and Rabbi Mintz is the rabbi of Kehilat Re'im Ahuvim in Manhattan. He's director of 929 English. He teaches at Yeshivat Marat, assistant professor at City College in New York, and he finds time to teach for Torah in Motion every once in a while when I bother him enough. So it's a pleasure to welcome back. I asked him to teach a few months ago. He said he's finishing up his book. When he finishes his book, he's happy to give a series on Erevin. So here we are. Bakasha, Rabbi Mintz, it's all yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Jay. It's nice to be back, and it's nice for you always to keep on me, and to, I mean, it's a pleasure to be convinced to come back to Torah in Motion, please God, for a long time to come. Eruv. Eruv's a good topic. Actually, there was an article in the New York Times today about the Eruv in Brooklyn. So as if they were publicizing Torah in Motion, got some publicity today in the New York Times about the Eruv in Brooklyn, which is its own fascinating topic. So what I really want to do in this series is talk about the history of the Eruv in America. Next week, we'll talk about St. Louis, which was the first Eruv in history in 1896. The week after that, the Eruv in Toronto, even though we're an international Zoom class, but Toronto is still home, and we'll talk about the Eruv in Toronto. And then finally, we'll come back to my home, and that is we'll talk about the Eruv in Manhattan. But we have to start at the beginning. And the beginning takes us all the way back. And that's the fact that we know that coming up in a couple of weeks in the Torah derives actually from the beginning of Parshat Vayakel, where the Torah juxtaposes the laws of Shabbos with the description of the building of the Mishkan, that there are 39 prohibited activities on Shabbos, the 39 types of work that were used in the building of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle, are the 39 types of work that are forbidden on Shabbos. And one of those types of work is carrying. Now, carrying means a lot of different things. Carrying means putting something in your pocket outside. Carrying means pushing a baby carriage. Carrying probably means having a baseball catch. Anywhere that's a public property. Carrying is permitted in a private property, in your own home, in your own little area, but it's prohibited in a public area. Now, understandably, from the very beginning, the rabbis understood that the prohibition of carrying creates a difficulty very specifically in the ability to observe Shabbos and to enjoy Shabbos. If you can carry, well, you can't carry food through the streets, and you can't, even before they had shuls, it mostly affected food. You couldn't carry food if people, and we'll talk about it in a minute. If you shared meals, you couldn't carry food from one place to the other. So while the Gemara in one place identifies the Eruv with King Solomon, with Shlomo HaMelech, really the source of the Eruv is the rabbis in the first century CE, during the time when the Romans controlled Judea, Palestine. It was the time of, it was what they called Roman Palestine. The Romans were in charge. We know the Romans took over in 63 BCE. That's not the Talmudic period. The Talmudic period, the Mishnaic period, is more like after the destruction of the temple until around the year 200 CE. That was the time of the creation of the idea of Eruv. Now, not surprisingly, to understand how Eruv works, we need to understand how people lived. How were houses situated to understand why we need an Eruv and how we need an Eruv? And therefore, what I want to do is I want to share a screen with you, and I want to just show you how people live. Here we go. What we have here is, this is basically a diagram of what a neighborhood look like in Roman Palestine? You see that there are three homes around a shared courtyard. The courtyard went into an alleyway called a mavoi. Sometimes there would be additional courtyards coming out of the side of the alleyway. On the way to the public, you call it here the public sphere. We would just call it a street, a public street. Often at the end of the public street, there would be a marketplace. That is the way every neighborhood looks in the time of Roman Palestine. Actually, if you go to the old city of Jerusalem, there are still some areas in which you have houses are surrounding a courtyard. But you have to understand something very important about the world 2,000 years ago. Rabbi Kelman was just talking about the fact that it was 15 degrees in Toronto yesterday, a miracle for February. But think about Palestine a lot of the year. Think about the summer in Jerusalem, how hot it could get. And of course, they didn't have air conditioning. They didn't have ventilation. It really got hot. You know what they did in the summer? And of course, the summer in Israel really goes from May to October. It's a long summer. What they used to do is they used to eat their meals outside in the courtyard. Not only did they eat their meals outside on a really hot day, they would hang out outside. They would do whatever they did outside. And sometimes they would even sleep outside. Now, what was the legal status of that courtyard? That courtyard actually is shared property, right? It really belongs to everybody whose house is, is around the courtyard. So that is shared property, and that's where people performed many of the activities that we perform at home. What's the problem with that courtyard? The problem with that courtyard is that that courtyard opens to the Reshut HaRabin, to the public street. Now, it doesn't open directly, and this will be something that'll be important in a little while. It doesn't open directly. There's an alleyway, but the alleyway opens into the public street. And therefore, if you have a rabbinically kind of creative mind, you say the courtyard is not really private. It's not really a backyard. Really, it's a courtyard that enters into the public space. And therefore, the rabbi said that there's a problem taking things from your house into the courtyard on Shabbat. Because if you take things from the courtyard into the courtyard, the courtyard is a public space because it opens into the public sphere. Now that created a tremendous difficulty for the people who lived in the houses. Because again, it was very difficult to stay at home all Shabbat. They needed to be able to use the courtyard. So the rabbis in the Mishnah had an idea. The rabbis in the Mishnah said that what you can do is you can close off the courtyard. Actually, without getting too complicated, there are two places you can close off the courtyard. You either can close off the courtyard at the point where the courtyard moves into the alleyway, or you can close off the courtyard in the place where the alleyway moves into the public sphere. Either one of those is okay, as long as you cut it off from the Reshut HaRabin. Now, generally speaking, when you close something off, you need to close it off with a wall. The courtyard itself is walled, right? Generally, this diagram is not perfect. Because generally what would happen is that the houses themselves would create the walls of the courtyard. But the rabbi said that in order to allow you to carry on Shabbat, a real wall is not necessary. All that's necessary is a symbolic wall. And a symbolic wall needs only poles and a string or a wire that goes on the top of those poles. In these two cases, you see that the two sides of the courtyard or the two sides of the alleyway probably made the poles on either side. So all you would need to do was to run a string from one opening in the courtyard to the other opening in the courtyard. And symbolically, that would close off the courtyard. Closing off the courtyard makes the courtyard into a private space. And because it's a private space, it becomes the private space of everybody who lives in the courtyard. And therefore, what is allowed to carry from the house into the courtyard, from the courtyard into the house. So therefore, the first piece of Eruv that's important is the fact that the rabbis say that what you need to do is you need to close off the courtyard. By closing off the courtyard, you've created an insular Eruv community where the houses and the courtyard are their own community cut off from the Rishut HaRabbi. That's all good. The problem is, and let me just go off of this for 1 minute. The problem is that that wasn't really enough because, you know, you cut off, you separate the courtyard from the Rishut HaRabim. But actually, what you have is, think about it for a minute. Think about your street at home. You have, or even your apartment house. The Sugarmans live in an apartment house, right? Even think about your apartment house. You don't have that much to do with your neighbors. You wouldn't say that you're a community on whatever floor you live on. You're a community with your neighbors. You might know your neighbors, but you're not a community with your neighbors. So the fact that you have three houses surrounding the courtyard doesn't by definition turn that into its own neighborhood. The rabbis say that you need one more thing. What you need is you need the ability to share food. Share food. Everybody who lives in the courtyard needs to contribute to a joint Shabbos food that will be eaten by everybody who lives in the courtyard. That's pretty easy for us to understand. You have a courtyard shalant. One person brings the potatoes, one person brings the beans, and one person brings the meat. Now, all of a sudden, what have you accomplished by doing that? What you've accomplished is that now all of a sudden you have an Eruv community. Now the three families who live in that area surrounding the courtyard, all of a sudden, they are now one community. What makes them a community? Well, we're Jews. What makes us a community is that we eat together. We share food. We have a joint food item that we all contributed to and that we all eat together. That, the Gemara says, are the two steps that are necessary for creating a neighbor. Number one, setting off the area, the courtyard, from the Rishut HaRabim, from the public space. And number two, creating an Eruv community by joining everybody together through the participation in a joint food that's going to be eaten by everybody on Shabbos. Now, again, you understand, people ate in the courtyard. So everybody was basically eating together anyway. So now they have an official challenge, which they're able to share with one another. Now, when you think about it for a minute, and this is going to be halach lemaisa in a few weeks, Eruv tapshilin, right? We use the word Eruv in different ways. This is what we call an Eruv tapshilin, right? Eruv tapshilin is, this is what you call an Eruv chatzerot. This is an Eruv around the chatzer, a courtyard. But we use the word Eruv in another context, was an Eruv tapshilin. An Eruv tapshilin is what you take a matzah and an egg, before Yontif, if Yontif is going to be Friday, to allow you to cook from Friday into Shabbos. Now, the word Eruv, Rabbi Silverberg, is really the same word Eruv, because Eruv means to unite. Eruv means to combine together, right? Same thing. Eruv Tavshilin, you're joining Shabbos and Yontif. Erev Chatzeros, you're joining the people who live around the around the courtyard. So actually, it's just interesting. The word Erev, which is a familiar word to us, is actually used in a completely different context, but it means the same thing. It means creating a unity from something that is not automatically unified. Yontif to Shabbos is not automatically unified, and the community is not automatically unified around the courtyard. You make an Eruv that unifies that community. Now, also interesting, when you make an Eruv Tavshilin, you recite a bracha, and when you make an Eruv Chatzeros, you also recite a bracha. And that's the tradition. It's the same bracha, Al Mitzvahs Eruv, unifying a community or unifying Shabbos and Yom. That is the history of Erev. But of course, nothing is so simple. Now, what's interesting is that you learn something from the Mishnah about how Jews lived in Roman Palestine. You might guess, you know, there are Jews in Roman Palestine, and there are Romans in Roman Palestine. You might guess the Jews had their courtyard and the Romans had their own courtyard, right? They had different courtyards because Jewish courtyard and a Roman courtyard. Actually, the Mishnah tells us that that wasn't always so. We know that from historical sources as well, but the Mishnah itself tells us that. The Mishnah tells us that sometimes there were non-Jews living in the courtyard. Uh-oh. Now we have a little bit of a problem. What's the problem? So what we said was the whole purpose of an Eruv is to combine the community, to make the community around the courtyard one unified Eruv community. Now, if there's a non-Jew living in the community, then you might say that that non-Jew is irrelevant. You have an Eruv community, and one of the people in the community is not Jewish. So, okay, you have a community, and the non-Jew is not part of the community. The problem is that really isn't true. You know, it's one thing you say you live in an apartment house. So some of the people you know in the apartment house, and some people you don't know in the apartment house. You live on a street in Toronto. Some people you know, some people you don't know. You choose to know the people you know, and you choose not to know the people you don't know. The problem is that if you live three houses around the courtyard and you're forced to live basically in the courtyard 6 months a year because it's hot in Jerusalem in the summer, you don't have the luxury to say, you know, I like some of my neighbors and I don't like other neighbors, right? I'll have dinner with one neighbor, but I won't have dinner with the other neighbor. It's not going to work. Everybody's going to have to figure out how to get along together. And therefore, to say that the non-Jew is not part of the Eruv community, it's just not true. Everybody living around that neighborhood, around that courtyard, is part of your community. So the problem is, how can you create an Eruv community with a non-Jew who's part of your community, but they don't have anything to do with the Eruv? That is a question that bothered the rabbis. That was a difficult question. And what's great about that question is that's not a theoretical question like sometimes you find in the Mishnah. You know, Shor Shenagach es Hapara, right? What happens if an ox gores, you know, if an ox gores a cow, and what do you do? I mean, you might think that was theoretical. This is not theoretical. This happened all the time in those early centuries in Roman Palestine. There was a non-Jew who lived in the courtyard with Jews, and you couldn't just ignore them because they were part of the community. So the Mishnah and then the Gemara addresses this topic. And of course, it's a great topic. Here we go. Back to the sources. Back to the sources. Next source. The Gemara in Erevin. The Gemara in Erevin. Therefore, the sages said, an Eruv is not effective in a place where a Gentile is living, nor is the renunciation of rights to a courtyard in favor of the other residents effective in a place where a Gentile is living. The Gemara here is just kind of reviewing what we just said. An Eruv, if a Gentile lives around that courtyard, the Gentile can't just say, you know, forget about me. They're part of the community. It doesn't work. Therefore, carrying is prohibited in a courtyard in which a Gentile resides. Unless the Gentile rents out his property to one of the Jews for the purpose of the Eruv, regardless of the number of Jews living there. Let's just stop here. That's good enough for now. The Gemara is very much aware of the fact that Jews and non-Jews live together around these courtyards. And the Gemara is very much aware of the fact that we need a solution to create an Eruv community, even where non-Jews lived as part of that community. So the first suggestion in the Gemara is that the non-Jew renunciate his rights in the community. And the Gemara rejects that because that's a legal fiction, because the guy's living there. So he can't just say, I'm not living here. Consider me not living here. He's there. He eats the meals with you. He's part of your community. He shares your courtyard. He can't renunciate his rights to the community. The Gemara doesn't buy that. But the Gemara has another kind of legal way to deal with this. And the Gemara suggests that the way to address this issue is to have the non-Jew rent or lease his property to his Jewish neighbors. If the non-Jew leases his property to the Jewish neighbors, then the non-Jew may be there over Saturday. He may be in the courtyard, but legally, the non-Jew does not own his home on Shabbos. Now, the Gemara, that was the next paragraph, which we don't have to bother reading, I'll just tell you. The Gemara was very much aware of the fact that that lease arrangement, even if you have a good lawyer, that lease arrangement with the non-Jew is going to be a little sensitive. Renounce. Sorry, that's what I said. Sorry if I pronounced properly, but sorry for my accent. The lease arrangement is going to be problematic. Why is the lease arrangement going to be problematic? Because why is the non-Jew going to lease his property? What's he going to do? He's going to lease his property, you know, for the whole, he's going to give up his rights in his house all week long. So the Gemara introduces the idea of a symbolic lease for only Shabbos. And what that means, as explained by the Gemara and then Rashi, is that the Jews give the non-Jew literally a pruta, a nickel. And through the giving of that nickel, the Jews lease the property of the non-Jew for the duration of Shabbos. In that way, legally, it's a Jewish community around that courtyard. Because it's a Jewish community around that courtyard, only Jews are there. And therefore, the non-Jew does not interfere with the Eruv community. But at the same time, the non-Jew is not in any way threatened. And they were very concerned about this. The non-Jew doesn't feel threatened and therefore is not going to get angry. They weren't, I'll have to tell you the truth, they weren't so worried about a non-Jew feeling threatened. They were worried about the non-Jew retaliating against the Jews. But since they figured out a way to have a symbolic gesture of leasing, so therefore the non-Jew would go along with it. That would be part of kind of the community relationships that were created. So now we have the Eruv of Roman Palestine figured out. You have people living around. That's a good question. Do they have to lease it every Shabbos? Do they have to lease it every Shabbos? And the second question is, do they have to make that shalant every Shabbos? Or is one shalant a year enough? All good questions. It's a version of selling your chametz, not exactly, but I know what that question means, and I'll get to that question soon. Let's start again, just to review quickly. An Erev community, when it was created in Roman Palestine, was created in order to enable people who lived around a joint courtyard, and everybody lived around a joint courtyard, to be able to take food from their courtyard, from the courtyard to the house, and from the house into the courtyard. The rabbi said that two things were necessary. One is that you have to close off the courtyard from the street. And the second thing that was necessary is there needed to be a joint food of all the Jews in the courtyard, a joint shalom. At least in the Mishnah's understanding, this is the wire needs to be placed there every single Shabbos. It's not good enough to just have it once. It needs to be there every Shabbos. And the food needs to be shared every Shabbos. The Gemara raises one problem. That is, what about if a non-Jew lives in one of the houses around the courtyard? They do not allow for the non-Jew, to renounce his rights to his house. That doesn't make sense, the Gemara thinks. But they do allow a symbolic leasing of the house of the non-Jew. So in that case, the Jews technically own the entire courtyard, and therefore the Erev community is able to be created. Now, the question is, does that symbolic lease of the non-Jews' property need to be done every week? So in the time of the Mishnah, the answer is yes. This is something that happened every single week. They created the Erev every week. Probably they put up the string every week because they weren't so sophisticated to be able to put the string up so high. So probably they needed to take the string down during the week. They would put it up on Friday afternoon. They would arrange this joint shalant. They would lease the space from the non-Jew, and then they would be able to enjoy their Shabbos. Now, let me just make one comment. And that is the fact that, you know, this is actually a brilliant rabbinic maneuver to allow people to enjoy Shabbos. There was no alternative. Because again, they needed the courtyard. Carrying was not allowed. They had no choice but to create this arrangement of Eruv in order to allow people to celebrate Shabbos, to observe Shabbos. They couldn't eat without it because you couldn't eat inside. So you had to eat outside. And this was the only way to do it. So someone put in the chat, isn't this like selling your chametz? To put it in another term, isn't this just one more of those legal fictions that we get around, right? We sell our chametz, even though the chametz remains in the cupboard. We lend on interest. We just write some document that says it's not really interest, right? We don't cancel our loans at Shemitah because we have something called the Prizbal, right? We're good at that. We're very, very good at that. Legal fictions. And the answer is, yes, we have legal fictions. Now, you're going to tell me, why do we have legal fictions for some things and not for other things? You know, the answer is that's a good question, Rabbi Kelvin. We need a shiur on Hilchos Shabbos. We need to go through. The truth of the matter is, this is just a parenthetical remark for one second. We get around cooking on Shabbos too, right? We figured out how to have hot food on Shabbos morning, whether the food stays on all night or whether there are other ways to warm up the food. Means that's not a legal fiction. But in everything that we do, at least when it comes to the laws of Shabbos, we try to make it that you can still observe Shabbos, observe the celebration of Shabbos without violating Shabbos. That is really what Eruv is all about. That is the story of Eruv. Now, if that was it, and that if we still lived in courtyards, in houses surrounding courtyards, everything would be simple and I would have no book. But it didn't work out that way. We know it didn't work out that way. The Jews moved to Babylonia And more or less in Babylonia, their living conditions were like they were in Roman Palestine. And that is that people lived in private little communities, and those private little communities opened up into a public square or into a marketplace. So you had the same arrangement where you were able to close off the private community before it entered the public square, and the Eruv was created. And then the Jews moved to medieval Europe, medieval Ashkenaz, medieval France and Germany, and medieval Spain. And we're going to talk today about medieval Germany. We could talk about any of these countries, but the sources I have talk about medieval Germany. Actually talk about the city of Cologne. But every city in Europe was the same. Every city in Europe was the same, and it's the same to this very day. And that is that people no longer lived around courtyards. People's houses opened up directly onto streets. There was no longer a shared courtyard. People's houses opened up to a street, and that street opened up into a bigger street and into a bigger street until it got to the main street in the city. Now, two things are true about medieval cities. Number one about medieval cities is that, generally speaking, the Jews lived in Jewish neighborhoods. Okay? The Jews lived in Jewish neighborhoods. All the Jews lived together. Now, that doesn't mean that non-Jews... Computer. Yeah. Sorry. Doesn't mean that there were no non-Jews in the Jewish neighborhood. But Jews basically lived together. The Jewish street was often called, in whatever language, the Jewish street. That's number one. Number two is... that at least by the 1300s, most cities in Europe, at least in Germany and France, were surrounded by a wall. Why were they surrounded by a wall? For protection purposes. Now, that wall was very important because that wall at least served the purpose of enclosing the city. So at least you'd only have to worry about the other issues, but the city was enclosed. Okay? But what I want to talk about today, and this is really what interests me about Eruv today, and will interest me about Eruv as we continue this series. And that is, how did the rabbis throughout the ages apply the rules of the Mishnah, which seem to be very, very specific for a certain type of living situation around the courtyard? What did they do when Jews started living in cities and there were no more courtyards? Now, you understand that this is an amazing question. It's a question that comes up in so many different areas, but Eruv is one of the primary areas where this comes up, where all of a sudden the laws don't seem to apply anymore, because the laws as they were constructed were only constructed for a very specific living condition. The minute you change that living condition, how can you possibly have an Eruv, right? It's almost like a halachic crisis. The rabbis in the Mishnah didn't seem to take into account the fact that people would be living differently. Obviously, they didn't take that into account. We don't take into account how people are going to live 100 years from now. I have no idea how people are going to live 100 years from now. We worry about what it is today. They couldn't imagine in Roman Palestine that people would live on streets. They never had such a thing. But the problem is, the rabbis in the medieval period, what did they do? So they have two choices. One choice is to basically say that the laws of Eruvin no longer apply. There's a Maseches Eruvin, and it would become like all the other tractates in the Talmud that no longer apply, laws that apply to Nazir, right? Laws that apply to Sota. There are plenty of laws, plenty of tractates, the entire tractates, right, Ray Silverberg? How many tractates just don't apply anymore because we don't have it anymore? So Nazir doesn't apply anymore, and Sota doesn't apply anymore, and Erev doesn't apply anymore. So that's the end of it. We knock off it. But the rabbis were much smarter and better than that. What the rabbis did was they figured out how to apply the rules of the Talmud, the rules of the courtyard, to the new living situations. And the way I want to show this to you today is I want to look at one example, because that's always the way you do it, right? I want to look at one example. That example is the Eruv in Cologne, Germany, around the year 1175. There are probably more than a couple of hundred Jews who lived in Cologne in 1175. But it was a center, a German Jewish center. The Jews in Cologne in 1175 lived on two or three Jewish streets. One of the streets was called Judengasse. There was no wall around Cologne until the year 1300. Okay, that's the facts about Cologne. There was a rabbi in Germany at the time. His name was Eliezer ben Yoel Halevi. In rabbinic history, he has a name. He's called the Ravya. He was born in 1140 in Mainz. And around 1175, he moved around a little bit. Around 1175, he lived in Cologne. And as we'll see in 1 second, he was the one who they asked these questions to. This was a crisis, right? You have to remember, you say 1175. When did Jews come to Germany and France? Rashi lives from 1040 to 1105. That is the beginning of Jewish life in Ashkenaz. Before the year 1000, Jews did not live in Germany and France. Where exactly they lived is not our topic now, but Jews did not live in Germany and France. Around the year 1000, they started living in Germany and France. It's not surprising that it took 150 years for them to develop the communities and develop the self-confidence to be able to talk about the Eruv. Because again, the Eruv involves other people. The Eruv involves non-Jews, as we'll see in a second. Let's see what the Ravya writes about the Eruv in Cologne. So the Ravya writes as follows, and let's read the right-hand column before we read the left-hand column. And as I have lingered on these matters, talking about the laws of Eruv, because my relative, Rabbi Menachem, son of Rabbi Jacob, asked me about this matter. That's very rabbinic, right? You talk about these laws because someone asked you. Because in Worms, they had mavuot, which means alleyways, and the public go through them. And the mavuot do not belong to the inhabitants of the neighborhood. And the Jewish inhabitants are not permitted to shut the entrances because this road belongs to everyone in the city. And the roads cross each other and are open to one of the city streets. May we be allowed to carry an object through it on Shabbos if we put a beam on one side and a portal on the other? And from the times of my ancestors, they used to carry it. But our teacher, Rabbi Ephraim, contests this permission. And they did not accept his permission. This is why I wrote that I think that the permission of the ancestor stands and it is permitted. There are so many amazing things in that paragraph. Number one, rabbis get involved in topics because they're asked questions. That's true then and it's true now. The Ravya wrote a commentary on the Gemara, but he's a rabbi who lives in Cologne, who lives in Mainz. His cousin asks him a question. He has to deal with the question. what is the question? The question, of course, is that there are alleyways. We don't call them alleyways anymore, but he uses the Gemara terminology of alleyways to refer to the streets. He says, now we have streets in front of the house that go one to the other. They crisscross, right? He's describing any city we live in. You have streets that crisscross one another. And the Jews don't have the right to close off the streets. Can you imagine closing off the streets? So what are we going to do? How are we going to make an Eruv? And we have another thing. He tells you that the custom was to put up a beam and a wire in Mainz, and the Jews used to carry there. But this Rabbi Ephraim contested this permission. And the Ravya wants to defend the practice of the Jewish people. That's a very, very, very important point. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik has written about this. You know, today we have a luxury of being Orthodox. So, you know, we don't feel a need to protect or to defend the practices of everybody. We can just make it better. If the Eruv is questionable, we just make the Eruv better. If the Kashrus is questionable, we just make the Kashrus better. But in the medieval period, they didn't have that possibility, right? They have a town in which there are streets. There are no courtyards. How are we going to make an Eruv? The Rav Yossi says people are carrying. The Rav Yossi says if Jews carry, and obviously in those days it was Jews who were religious Jews. If religious Jews carry on Shabbos, they must be doing the right thing. That in itself, that's worth the whole class. That is so heartwarming to read that in the Rav Yossi. If religious Jews are doing something, they must be right. They must be doing the right thing. I don't believe they're violating Shabbos. And because I don't believe they're violating Shabbos, therefore it's my job to justify what they're doing. Okay? Isn't that great? We don't even know yet what he says, but he tells us ahead of time, don't worry about it. If you're doing it and that has been the custom, I am going to defend your practice. So here's the problem. We know the problem. The problem is a twofold problem. The problem is that the streets in the German cities do not look like the courtyards of old. That's problem number one. And problem number two is the Jews are carrying. Maybe if the Jews weren't carrying, he wouldn't care so much. But the Jews are carrying, so he needs to defend the practice. Okay? Let's see what he does. Here we go. The drama continues, and here we go. We're going to see what he does. Here we go. And even though there is a disagreement among the Amoraim, where one says that for an alley to be permitted by means of a beam or a doorpost, its houses and courtyards must open onto it, meaning two courtyards and two houses in each courtyard. While Rabbi Yochanan said even one house and one courtyard is sufficient. You see, in the Gemara, they have a whole discussion about what the community looks like, how the courtyard opens up into the alley. Obviously, if we rely on that, we're not going to have an Eruv in Mainz and in Worms, in Cologne. These words were applicable in those days when their courtyards were in front of their houses and one could pass through the courtyards to the public space. But in these days, when the houses are open directly to the mavoi, to the alleyway, and the courtyard is behind the houses, backyards, it is enough that the houses are open to the mavoi without a courtyard. This is my opinion. And thus I found support from Rabbi Yehuda ben Nathan's interpretation on behalf of Rashi. Okay, let's start with the last point. If you live in Germany, in 1175, you cannot do better than Rashi. So basically, if you can say that you are following in the footsteps of Rashi, that's going to give you a lot of credibility. So he ends by saying, and what I just told you, that's the tradition of Rashi. Can't argue with Rashi. But what does he say? He says something unbelievable. What he says is that the Gemara has a whole complicated discussion about exactly what the Eruv community needs to look like in order to create an Eruv on Shabbos. How the courtyards exactly open up into the alleyway and how the alleyway opens up into the street. And it's only if it opens up in a very specific way. The courtyard has to open into the alley and the courtyard has to have two houses. If the courtyard has only one house, it doesn't count. All of these things would negate the ability to create an Eruv in the medieval city. Because the medieval city doesn't have any of that. Doesn't have a courtyard opening up into an alleyway. It has one house opening up into a street, which he calls an alleyway. We'll come back to that in a second. What he says is that the language of the Talmud requiring the courtyards into the alleyways, that was only in those days. In our days, the ability to create an Eruv is not limited by the discussion in the Talmud. Today, even if the house opens directly onto the courtyard, you are allowed to create an Eruv. Now, he says it very matter of fact. But I want to tell you, that's an amazing comment of the Rav Yah. Because what the Rav Yah could have said is that the rules of the Talmud are not met in medieval Germany in 1175. Therefore, we can't build an Eruv. Instead, he says, no, the rules of the Gemara are the Gemara's rules. We have our own rules. Now, he does something that's very rabbinic. In the Gemara, as we saw the first diagram, the courtyard opens up into an alleyway. The alleyway opens up onto the street. That alleyway in the diagram, in the Mishnaic period, was really an alleyway. It was an alleyway. You had courtyards that opened up into a narrow alley, which opened up onto the real street. But he plays a little trick. The little trick Rav Yah plays is he calls the medieval streets an alleyway. Imagine Jews live along a street in Cologne. It's Judengasse. It's Jewish street. But it's a street, and it's not an alleyway, it's a street, the same way we have a street. Now, that street opens up into a bigger street, which eventually gets you to the town square, which is where they have the fairs and the stores and all the things. We know how streets work. It would be very easy to say that in medieval Germany, they had no alleyways. It didn't work that way. Or maybe they had alleyways in the back of the houses, you know, the way some communities have alleyways in the back of their houses. But that there were no alleyways. And therefore, the categories of the Gemara don't apply. But Rav Yah is much smarter than that. He says, no, no, no. The medieval streets, they have the status of an alleyway. Why do they have a status of the alleyways of the Mishnah? Because they open up into bigger streets, which are more public, which eventually gets you to the town square. But you understand the brilliance of the Rav Yah? If he made up his own categories, he would have nothing on which to rely because the Talmud tells us about courtyards and alleyways. The minute that he defines the medieval streets as alleyways, what he's done is he's saying that the medieval reality is actually just an extension of the Mishnaic, of the rabbinic alleyways, of the rabbinic categories. And the minute that you say that the medieval streets are alleyways, you're saying that it's okay. We're a direct line. There's a continuity from the Mishnaic period to the medieval period. Just the use of the word, you see, that's the brilliance. Just the use of the word allows there to be a continuity. And all of a sudden, the laws that permitted the creation of an Eruv in the Mishnaic period allow the creation of the Eruv in the medieval period. It's amazing. But actually, that jump that was made in the 12th century in Germany is a jump that we still rely on today in 2023. That was the jump that we needed. Without the Rav Yud's jump, we're helpless. Now, maybe someone else would have done it, but the Rav Yud did it. You understand? We have a change in the way people live. You would think that that makes Eruv irrelevant, but the Rav Yud is willing to redefine his terms, to call the medieval streets alleyways in the Mishnaic terminology of alleyways, thereby explaining that the medieval cities, the Jewish living conditions in these medieval cities is actually a direct continuation of the Mishnaic living conditions. And therefore, just like the Mishnah allowed for an Eruv, we can have an Eruv in the medieval cities. All we need to do is just to put up the beams and the wires at the end of the street. Now, it's interesting that what he doesn't discuss are two things. Number one is he does not discuss how they got permission to put up those beams and strings at the end of the street. Bob, that's pretty amazing, right? The most important question of all, how in the world, who did he go to? Did he go to the government? Did he have a lawyer? Who did he go to? How did he get permission? So I can't answer that question. My gut tells me that if it was an issue, he would have written about it. So somehow it was simple. So you wrote in the chat, maybe they had a relationship, you know, with the local authorities. You know, maybe in Germany in the 12th century, there wasn't a kind of very powerful authority. Every town had their own authorities. And if you were friendly with the authorities, you could get permission to do something like that. That's possible. But, you know, that's missing. You would think that that would be there. The fact that it's not there tells me something about the relationship with the non-Jews. That wasn't an issue. The Jews, for some reason, had the right to do that. And there's something else he doesn't discuss, which is less of a problem in terms of that. He doesn't discuss about renting the space from non-Jews. Now, you say that maybe only Jews lived on the Jews' street. Maybe. But we know that that's not really true. That even though basically Jews live there, but there are always going to be non-Jews who are going to live there because for whatever reason, they're going to be non-Jews who are going to live in some of these buildings. There were buildings along these streets. So non-Jews live there too. The reason the Rav Yud doesn't discuss this is because that's not the Rav Yud's topic, right? The Rav Yud's topic was understanding how the alleyways of the Mishnaic period became the streets of the medieval period. That was the Rav Yud's topic. He wasn't interested in the idea of renting from non-Jews. That's in a different place in the Gemara, and he wasn't interested in that. But I'm interested in that. What did they do? How did they handle non-Jews living on those streets? So let's say there are 200 Jews living there, right? All of a sudden, the courtyards of 10 people become the streets of 200 people. But let's say there are 25 non-Jews living there. I'm making it up, obviously. But let's say there are 25 non-Jews living there. What are they going to do? So I know what they're going to do. They're going to lease the apartments or the houses of 25 non-Jews on the Jewish street every single Friday afternoon. So you know that that's not true. You don't need to be a rabbinic scholar to know that that's not true. They didn't do that because that's not practical to do. There must have been a solution. So I need to jump a little bit, but I want to read you something in the Shulchan Aruch that addresses this topic, and which probably was true in the 12th century in Cologne, even though I can't quite, it's hard for me to map it out right now in the class. The Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Joseph Caro, who's writing in the 16th century, but is clearly reflecting a medieval period. You are required to lease from each courtyard of the non-Jew. It is not sufficient to lease from the head of the city, right? You have to go to the 25 people in Cologne, and you have to lease their space. This is describing a case where the governing official does not own the houses of the city and does not have the right to use the houses, even in a time of war. However, in a city where all the activities of the city are conducted under the auspices of the governing official or his assistant, then leasing from the official or his assistant is permitted. For he has permission to place people and weapons in the houses during a time of war, even without the knowledge or consent of the residents. Very interesting. The Shulchan Aruch raises a new possibility. That new possibility is the ability to lease the space, not from each individual person, but from the head of the government. Now, he kind of defines it. What does it mean to be the head of the government? That you can place troops or weapons in the house at a time of war. Which is, I want to tell you something. That's not a very strong type of authority. Because you would imagine that in the time of war, they would be more permissive, right? It means that I want to save the place. So therefore, I'd allow them to put troops in. So it doesn't have to be a very strong type of authority. But he needs to have a certain type of authority that he can go into the houses. This is going to be important next week, a plug for next week's class. In St. Louis, they're going to have a question whether the police have this authority. Since in theory, police maybe can go into the houses. I mean, that needs to be discussed. But maybe the police can go into the houses. And therefore, maybe they have this type of authority. But what the Shulchan Aruch raises is something we haven't seen before. And that is that, as you know, when the Jews lived around the courtyard, it was fine to go to the one non-Jew in the courtyard and to lease his space, to give him a nickel and lease his space, and everybody was friends. The evolution of the community to streets raises another problem, and that is the numbers. All of a sudden, the numbers are greater. Now, we didn't discuss about the Jews sharing food, that we're not going to have time to do that. Let's just suffice to say that the tradition of taking a box of matzah on behalf of everybody in the Eruv also was created during this period. But I was more interested, that's interesting, we'll come back to that. But I was more interested in the non-Jewish issue. What did they do with the non-Jews living on Judengasse? And the answer is that they created another legal fiction. And that is, I can't lease the space from every non-Jew, but I can lease the space from the person who represents every non-Jew. Who is the person who represents every non-Jew? The government official who has authority over the houses. Because what I'm leasing is the houses. So if this person has the right to put weapons or soldiers into each house, so then he has authority over the houses. I can, in theory, lease from him. You understand, of course, that this was also done out of necessity. Had we not said this, there would have been no way to lease the property because they couldn't go to every non-Jew. It wouldn't have worked. There always would have been somebody who would have messed it up. Right, who said, no, I'm not going to lease it to you. They had no relationship with these people, so that wasn't practical. They needed a solution. And this was the solution they came up with. Today, we talked about the creation of the Eruv and the evolution of the Eruv in a medieval context when the Jews no longer lived in the construct that they lived in the Mishnaic period. What we're going to do next time is, we're going to take this issue into cities. Next time we'll talk about St. Louis and then Toronto and then Manhattan. How do these ideas actually apply when they talk about cities in the modern period? What we're going to see is that many of the considerations that the Rabbia used in 1175 in Cologne will be used in St. Louis next week. Have a great week, everybody. Shabbat Shalom. And I look forward to seeing everybody next Thursday. Be well.
Thank you, Rabbi. Yes. Okay. You went through most of the questions, right? I just wonder if you want to take a
quick question. I went through most of them. I'm just going to look at them. Yeah, Toronto has a major street. We're getting to Toronto in 2 weeks. Correct. Alleyways behind them. That's fine. We know about that. Professor Agus, amongst other used to date Ashkenazi settlement to the ones of the Columbus rabbis from Italy invited by one of the Charlie's, that more than 100 years before the millennium. Okay, I mean, that's fine. You know, I don't know why we don't have an example, a discussion of Eruv before the Rav Yah, but we don't. I don't know why that is. 13 families cross the Rhine, right? That's an interesting discussion. Of course, in Ochot Shabbos, it's useful that Rabbi Kelman is for you, not for me. Okay. Drinking wine. Okay. That's the same point. It's, when did they allow it? When did they not allow it? That's a good question. Okay. Thank you very much, everybody. Shabbat shalom and be well.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Okay. At 1 p.m., Dr. Daniel Lasker will be talking, Does God Talk to Humans? Very from halacha to philosophy. He's continuing his course on how to be a Jewish philosopher. So that will be in exactly an hour from now on the same station. And then at 8:30 p.m. tonight, our regular Parsha Shir, Rabbi Dr. Benjamin Samuels from Newton, Charlottesville, Newton will be giving the Parsha Shir tonight on law and narrative and Shmut and beyond, the relationship between law and narrative. And tomorrow morning will be my regular class on the Siddur, Birchas Kriyat Shema. That's what we're talking about now, 9:30 in the morning. Sunday, of course, Rabbi Liebtag continues his series of our regular classes. On Monday, Shuli Mishkin will be beginning a new series on the neighborhoods in Yerushalayim. So that's up online. You can register. We'll send out an email and everybody be well. We hope to see you soon. And all right. Invite a friend and have a nice day. And thanks a lot, everybody. Bye-bye.